Thank you very much indeed. And I'm very conscious that you've had a long day. I have myself been visiting intermittently since maybe 3 o'clock in the morning here. So I will try to keep my comments reasonably within time. I do not have a presentation, as I find that it's possible to speak from a presentation or from a script, but difficult to do both. I do have a book that I would like to call to your attention. It's here. It's called Entropy Economics, The Living Basis of Value in Production. It was published by University of Chicago earlier this year, which provides some, will give you some idea of the underlying framework for the remarks that I'm going to make right now, specifically focused on the period that's of interest to your conference. I never got to the USSR, having missed two opportunities. The first might have happened around 1965, as President Kennedy had raised the possibility of sending my father to serve as ambassador, and given my father's views on such matters as Vietnam, Cuba, and for that matter, the Soviet Union, the obvious purpose would have been to bring an end to the Cold War at that date. Dallas precluded that possibility. The second was in 1970, to accompany my parents on a visit to the Soviet Academy of Sciences. The invasion of Cambodia and the murders at Kent State caused my father to cancel that trip. Though I have to say I'm proud and very honored today to belong to the Russian Academy of Sciences, as it now is, to have visited and spoken at CME on several occasions, to be listed as a visiting professor at the Moscow School of Economics, Moscow State University, as well as an honorary professorship in the Urals, and to count several people on this program as longstanding friends. And I'll mention in particular and send warm greetings to Ruslan Grinberg, who I believe is going to be speaking tomorrow, and especially to Viktor Polterovich, whom I had the privilege of listening to briefly this morning. In late 1992, I received two papers from a close observer of the Soviet economic space, Professor Axel Leon Hufford of the University of California at Los Angeles at that time, who was then advising Nursultan Nazarbayev in Kazakhstan. The version I have is dated from 2001. It's entitled Reform and the Fate of Russia, and it was co-authored with Erlene Craver. And I'll take their argument as my point of departure. Their central point was that the Soviet economy had been designed for scale efficiency, such that for many, and perhaps most, industrial products, there was just one or two suppliers, and often just one or maybe two buyers. Johannes Lin of the Brookings Institution noted in a paper in 2004 that 34 of 65 items of agricultural equipment were produced by just one firm apiece. And he gives the example of a hay baler factory in the Kyrgyz Republic that depended on a compressor part produced only in Russia and Estonia by one firm in each. Obviously could not survive the interruption of production of either supplier. The system functioned effectively as a single production line with adequate technical efficiency, allowing for the fact that factories were built at different times, had different technological vintages and different degrees of modernity and states of repair, but with the vulnerability of the modern factory, which is that a break anywhere could bring the whole operation to a halt. The origin of this system in the war economy and the necessity of discipline, which is true of any factory, or for that matter, repression when you take it to the scale of the society as a whole, on such a system, I think goes without saying, without need for further explanation. It was evident to Leon Hufford that such a system could not survive being decentralized and split into separate operating firms, let alone being privatized, for as he wrote, the game of bilateral monopoly has no core. Or to quote, the partially decentralized economy of the Soviet Union in its last years did violate the logic of command economies, but did not on that account obey the logic of market economies. As soon as an upstream partner raised prices or sold outside the chain, the downstream firm would face losses, go into debt or arrears, effectively the same thing, cease to pay taxes, all to avoid stopping operations. Intervention then by the regional governments to provide finance would then threaten the national structure, not only between the republics of the USSR, but also within the Russian Federation. To reiterate a point made just a few minutes ago by Professor Sagelbaum, in particular, raising energy prices toward world levels, ostensibly to reflect the true value of the production in the coal mines and the petroleum wells and so forth, would mean by itself the collapse of cash flow productivity, profitability of the downstream sectors in a system in which their energy prices were at that time set to be about 1% of world levels. And at the same time, external debt, which had been taken on heavily by the Soviet Union, and that was also reflected in one of the charts of Professor Bretkitschild earlier today, dictated the export of resources at world prices for hard currency to pay those debts, putting unbearable pressures on the industrial system as it had been designed to operate. In this setting, price reform, price decontrol, liberalization, it was a chimera. And banking, in the normal sense, and it's been noted that commercial banks did not exist, of course they didn't, was effectively impossible. While decentralization also eliminated the raison d'etre of the Communist Party. Shortly, the national breakup would add the complications of international borders, disrupted transport, and hard currency settlement, exactly as it did in Yugoslavia when that broke up and elsewhere. Nomenclatura privatization and effectively looting asset stripping took over, and the failures eventually cascaded up and down the chain so that perestroika gave way to depression. Those centrifugal forces of decentralization and the longer control from the center led toward war and might have led to the destruction of the Russian Federation. In fact, I think a reasonable inference that fostering the breakup of Russia, not supporting its recovery, was an objective of forces within the West, if not their declared policy. I do say that, that actually Unhofer asked me to send his papers to Strobe Talbot, to the Clinton administration, of which Strobe Talbot was the leading advisor on Russia, which I did, and never received the slightest acknowledgement, and I doubt that his points would have been appreciated even if they had been read. I won't belabor this analysis to pursue it post-1991, which is to say beyond perestroika and into collapse, but I'll make two or three observations that are pertinent to a comparison with China. The first is that looting was made vastly more lucrative by the collapse of barriers to capital flight. You then take the money that you earned and move it out of the country. It was obviously highly advantageous and with dire consequences for Russians, of course, but also for the political economy of the Western countries who were awash in flight capital and the associated exiles. Second, the Soviet collapse occurred at a high watermark of neoliberal necromancy and economic thought, and magical thinking overwhelmed the policy apparatus. The economics of a pre-industrial commercial economy of the kind familiar, say, to Adam Smith, was asserted to apply to an economy of an interlocking industrial system, where it simply overlooked the fact that since Adam Smith there were several centuries of further technological and industrial development. I wrote in 1989 that the East Europeans, and I meant in this to include the Russians, could, roughly quoting, go to sleep on the train to Stockholm and find that they were waking up as the boat docked in Buenos Aires. And that is, I think, roughly what happened. Third, to say a word in defense of Jeffrey Sachs, an old friend from dating before this period, actually, and I don't think he understood what or who he was dealing with in Russia. But he did realize that debt relief was essential, as it had been in Bolivia and in Poland, where Grzegorz Kolodko was able to bring down the external debt by a factor of 50%. But he could not persuade the U.S. government, well, he tried, under President Clinton, to take that step, a fact which I think betrays the geopolitical objectives of certain important and perhaps dominant forces in Washington then and since. I arrived in China in early 1994, and under a United Nations Development Program contract and on a UN per diem, as a chief technical advisor to the State Planning Commission for Macroeconomic Reform and Strengthening Institutions. That was a very overstated title, but an extremely interesting assignment. It was mainly a training mission, and for me, an opportunity to observe and learn, which carried on for about 4 years. The question, why was China's experience so different, has too many answers, but I'll take a heroic stab at itemizing some of the most important, as I observed at the time. And in particular, in view of the central point previously made, as I summarized from the Leonhufvud and Craver analysis. China, to begin with, was already decentralized. As a matter of defensive industrial design under in the Maoist period, to cope with the potential threat that was, of course, coming principally from the Soviet Union. So the elements of resilience and potential competition were already present in the Chinese economy in the period before reforms began in the middle to late 1970s. Moreover, China's major regions were large, and they were strong. They were not numerous, fragmented, and weak, as was the case in Russia in the post-Soviet space. The central government was actually relatively small. It was one of my early lessons is that communist governments tend not to be large by comparison with the ones that I was familiar with in the United States. The Planning Commission was certainly no ghost plan, and though it did play an important coordinating role and helped to hold the country together. I learned some things about language in China, that the phrase macroeconomic control did not mean monetary and fiscal policy, as I had been brought up to believe from the textbooks of that era, but rather extracting the problem of how to extract sufficient revenues from the wealthy provinces to keep the rather strapped central government solvent. The phrase market integration did not mean or what you might have thought in a European context it would mean, but rather how to bring the existing somewhat autonomous regional economies into contact with each other and to how to meld their industrial and other systems in such a way that they would become mutually supportive rather than centrifugal and mutually destructive. China had, of course, an immense rural labor reserve, that's a well-known fact, and for that reserve, Spartan industrial employment was attractive and could be moved into light industry producing consumer goods. But that then raised another question, was how to produce consumer goods that people might actually find desirable under a system that did not have the practices and disciplines of a market economy. And China managed to solve that problem, the problem of product quality. It's obviously an issue under socialism, and they did it, I think, effectively by importing standards from the West. China was too poor to satisfy consumer needs by importing the goods themselves, as Russia could do, for example, from Turkey when the barriers came down, and did do. But over time, China could, in fact, import the standards and learn to upgrade the quality of its own production, and eventually to develop the regulatory capacities to make the production self-sustaining and self-advancing, so that you see the Chinese system as it presently is moving toward, if not already at, the leadership of technology and product quality in the world. It was certainly not that way in the 1990s. China avoided seduction by the apostles of big banks and shock therapies, and it was a great contribution of Deng Xiaoping to resist those urgents and imprecations. That debate had played out in the 1980s and was well documented in a very important book by Isabella Weber, How China Escaped Shock Therapy. There were no mass privatizations, but a gradual process of institutional diversification and organic development and expansion. China never opened its capital account, a risk against which I made a point of warning, and with some success, in 1995. In fact, I organized a conference outside of Beijing for 3 days in a place called Huairu, where the Women's Conference had been held the previous year, and brought over two important voices. One of them was Robert Eisner of Northwestern University, and the other was Jane DiResta, banking expert, specifically to convey the view that opening the capital account was an avenue toward extreme danger, indeed disaster. And the temptation, which was again present in the middle 2000s, was averted by the world financial crisis of 2007. So the Chinese were able to move along by maintaining control of their own financial system and keeping the vast sums that were accumulated in the market system largely, not wholly, but largely within their national frontiers. And finally, and this is of great importance, China had Russia's experience front and center in their faces in 1994. The horror of what had happened in Moscow in 1993 was very vividly conveyed to me by senior officials that I happened to speak with in Beijing in 1994, as well as the larger human and demographic catastrophe affecting the Russian Federation at that time. And these were people who felt that they had only narrowly escaped a similar trajectory in 1989, a few years previously. So while American elites were imagining that the lure of free markets and Western-style democracy was irresistible, the fact was, if you were even casually talking to the people in Beijing at the time, that wasn't what they were looking at all, and that wasn't going to happen. I make these observations fully aware that they are selective and somewhat superficial. But I think they point to a conclusion that while China and the USSR both developed under imperatives of national defense, China did so in a way that was fortuitously transformable, while the USSR did not, possibly because it could not. The basis for this distinction, or the bases, were demographic, topographic, historical, but there was also an ideological element. Both China and the Soviet Union were heavily exposed to the end of history free market dogmas of that moment, the 1980s and 1990s, but Russia was more open, it was more exposed. And it succumbed, paying an extra and rather severe, I would say even terrible price, in a situation that was going to be difficult under any conditions. It's no accident that Russia's recovery began to take place in the late 1990s, when circumstances began to impose a further change of ideas, and specifically, of course, the financial crisis of 1998 and the default and the devaluation. And I came to Russia, I started coming in 1993, but I came to Russia in, I think it was 1998, just after this happened, and was picked up at the airport by an old friend, Stanislav Menshikov, who had reports on the recovery of the Russian economy. It came about quite, began to happen quite quickly. once the external financial conditions made it necessary to move in that direction. Now, however, I venture to guess, and this is an hypothesis, if you like, that the ideological advantage has shifted in Russia's favor. In China, I fear the absence of a severe crisis, the precisely the success over the last 40 years, means that inoculation against the dogmas of the neoliberal era hasn't fully occurred. And Chinese academic economics is flush with emulators of the Anglo-American mainstream, and people who are striving to be noticed in this hierarchy of journals and university rankings and so forth that come with conforming to a particular view of how economies should be run. Such people are not, for the moment, in power. I don't think they're particularly influential, but they are prevalent throughout the academic structures that I'm familiar with in China. And if they do come to power eventually, which might happen, they would be capable, as history shows, of inflicting very considerable damage. Two factors, therefore, advantage the Russian case. The first is historical memory. Just as the U.S. was protected from Herbert Hoover and Calvin Coolidge and their ideas of the 1920s and 1930s for a full generation longer after the Great Depression, Roosevelt and the New Deal was a kind of a wall, a protective barrier against those ideas until the late 1970s when they returned. The second is the force majeure of sanctions and the need to adapt to them, which has forged a regime of capital control that wasn't previously there, a national financial system substantially more independent than the one that existed just a few years ago, a division of loyalties of the previously existing oligarchy, to those who left the country and those who did not, and development once again rooted in both abundant energy and investments in modern infrastructure, but this time with a diversified industrial overlay that has the resilience, could have the resilience, that was previously lacking. I have described this as the gift of sanctions, as the Russian government would, I think, have been politically and ideologically unable and unwilling to take the steps that it was obliged to take by the actions of the European West powers and the United States over the last decade or so, particularly since 2022. And had the sanctions not been imposed, it would be, I think, very difficult to imagine that Russia would now be considered by the IMF to be the fourth largest purchasing power economy in the world, which is the result of a growth rate that happened, that began to take shape in the wake of the system crisis imposed by the sanctions in 2022. Would it be too much to describe this as perestroika in the long run? I think perhaps it would be too much. But I think that my father would recognize some elements of the new industrial state, his book, 1967, which characterized the United States a half century ago as what is now lost, a system that mixed the power of large industrial corporations and had integrated operations with the operations of an extensive market economy, along with the social balance for which he argued and which the U.S. was always somewhat deficient, that is to say, between public services and private initiative. The one thing that would have remained on his agenda and on which he would have acted if history had taken a different course in the 1960s is an end to the Cold War, to the proxy wars, to the balance of terror, to the nuclear threat, and the establishment of a durable peace with security all around, everybody's interests taken equally into account. That is, of course, a utopian thought, but I am a faithful son of my father's, and it's not a bad one on which to close. Пусть будет ещё война никогда. Спасибо большое.